is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight, a warning by Washington against those who obstruct Somalia's path to peace. And Mali's government denies hiring mercenaries from the controversial Wagner Group. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Somalia's allies are expressing alarm over the intensifying row between the President, Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, better known as Farmajo, and Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble. According to the French news agency AFP, relations between the two have long been frosty. On Sunday, the president suspended the prime minister, who then accused the president of instigating an attempted coup as soldiers loyal to him started taking positions near the presidential palace. There is now fear this latest incident could contribute to Somalia's instability as the country struggles to hold long-delayed elections and fight a jihadist insurgency. The Africa Bureau of the U.S. Department has warned that Washington is prepared to act against those who obstruct Somalia's path to peace. Mali's military government has denied hiring Russian mercenaries from the controversial Wagner Group, which has been sanctioned by the European Union for rights abuses. France and 15 other European nations last week condemned what they said was Russia's deployment of Wagner fighters to Mali. Mali's transitional government says it's only engaged with official Russian military trainers. Analysts weigh in on Russia's military involvement in Mali as French troops are drawing down. And this report by Annie Risenberg from Bamako, Mali.
Mali's transitional government this month denied what it called a baseless allegations that it hired the controversial Russian security firm, the Wagner Group, to help fight Islamist insurgents. Western governments and UN experts have accused Wagner of rights abuses, including killing civilians, in the Central African Republic and Libya. The response came Friday after Western nations made the accusations, which Mali's military government dismissed with a demand that they provide independent evidence. A day earlier, France and 15 other Western nations had condemned what they called the deployment of Wagner mercenaries to Mali. The joint statement said they deeply regret the transitional authorities' choice to use already scarce public funds to pay foreign mercenaries instead of supporting its own armed forces and the Malian people. The statement also called on the Russian government to behave more responsibly, accusing it of providing material support to the Wagner Group's deployment, which Moscow denies. The Mali government acknowledged what it called Russian trainers were in the country. It said they were present to help strengthen the operational capacities of their defense and security forces. Ali Tunkarda is director of the Center for Security and Strategic Studies in the Sahel, a Bamako-based think tank. He says it's hard to tell if the Russian security presence is military or mercenary, but regardless, would likely be supporting rather than frontline fighting. This could allow the Malian army to have victories over the enemy that will be attributed to them, says Tunkarda, which was not the case with the French forces. He says the second advantage is that the victories over the extremists could allow Mali's military to legitimize itself. We must remember, says Tunkarda, that one of the reasons for the forced departure of President Keita was that the security situation was so bad. Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, was overthrown in an August 2020 coup led by Colonel Assimi Goïta after months of anti-government protests, much of it over worsening security. Goïta launched a second coup in May that removed the interim government leaders, but has promised to hold elections in 2022. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has been pushing Mali's military government to hold elections. ECOWAS in November expressed concern over a potential Wagner Group deployment to Mali after unconfirmed reports that the military government was in talks with the mercenary group. Popular protests in Bamako have called for French forces to leave Mali, and last year some protesters were seen calling for Russian ones to intervene. Since French forces first arrived in Mali in 2013, public opinion on their presence has shifted from favorable to widely negative. The French military has been gradually drawing down its anti-insurgent Operation Barkhane forces from the Sahel region. French forces this year withdrew from all but one military base in northern Mali, saying the Malian armed forces were ready to take the lead on their own security. But analysts say one consequence of the French leaving is that the Malian army is seeking other partners. Boubacar Salif Traoré is director of AfriGlobe Conseil, a Bamako-based development and security consulting firm.
Cette coopération va beaucoup...
Official Russian cooperation would be very advantageous for the Malian army in terms of supplying equipment, he says. Traoré says Mali and many African countries, notably the Central African Republic, have concluded that France does not play fair in terms of delivering arms. Every time these states ask for weapons, he says, either there's an embargo or there's a problem in procuring these weapons. Traoré says Russia can provide these weapons without constraints, and it's precisely that which interests Mali. In September, Mali received 4 military helicopters and other weapons bought from Russia. The Malian transitional government's statement Friday did not elaborate on what the Russian trainers would be doing in Mali. When asked for comment, a government spokesman would not elaborate and referred questions to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which does not list any contact numbers on its website. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Despite shaky health systems and vaccine drives, the coronavirus pandemic did not hit Africa as badly as many feared, but it did take a toll on the continent's economies in 2021 as movement was restricted and also underscored vaccine inequalities. Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
When the coronavirus first hit Africa, many observers feared the continent's overall poor healthcare would result in massive casualties. Many Africans are high risk for severe infection due to diabetes and tuberculosis, both too common on the continent. But Africans make up just a fraction of COVID's global death toll. Dr. Mary Stephen is a technical officer with the World Health Organization's Africa region.
One good thing for Africa is that the young population is kind of an advantage for the continent, because even from the statistics for COVID, we have seen that the young people are presenting, majority of them really asymptomatic or mild symptoms. And so as a result, at the beginning of the first 2-3 waves, we see the reported cases are not so much in terms of people that end up in the hospital.
But vaccine inequities have left Africa vulnerable, with less than 10% of the population vaccinated. While vaccine shipments to Africa have increased in 2021, distribution remains a challenge. The WHO cites poor access to vaccines as causing virus variants and new waves of infections.
When the population is susceptible, of course, the virus has an opportunity to spread and mutate very well. We need more to do more to cover more populations in Africa so that we can reduce the risks of all this evolution of variants.
Western nations' travel bans over the Omicron variant have worsened the pandemic's economic damage, as many African countries rely on foreign tourists. In South Africa, the continent's worst-hit country by the pandemic, unemployment is near 35%. Frustrations exploded in July as political protests turned into widespread riots and looting. Lizette Lancaster is with the Institute of Security Studies in South Africa.
The politics of hunger and desperation has really come to the fore. And by July last year, as we started seeing an opening up of restrictions or less restrictions, we recorded the highest number of protests ever since we started monitoring protests in 2013. So people were desperate to be heard and desperate for help.
After the worst recession in decades, the African Development Bank projects an economic rebound for Southern Africa in 2022. But the ABD says that recovery also hinges on successful vaccination programs. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The International Monetary Fund recently announced that Zimbabwe will not qualify for a special debt relief program until it pays its dues to the World Bank. The decision has raised concern among analysts, many of whom are painting a bleak picture of the country's economic prospects. Adigando has more on the story.
Despite clearing its debt with the IMF, Zimbabwe still has an outstanding US $1.52 billion with the World Bank. The IMF says payment is a condition for any consideration of debt relief and qualification into an initiative called the Common Framework. Zimbabwe will have to wait till the preconditions for international re-engagement are firmly in place. VOA reached out to economic analysts to help unpack what the news means for Zimbabwe. Economics professor Gift Mugano says the door has been shut in Zimbabwe's face and explains the need for more money to shore up finances.
We have to rely more on domestic resource mobilization. That is why you are seeing that Mthuli is overtaxing us. He doesn't have the other sources of finance to support the economy. And like other African countries, which has good access to external capital. Well, one of our sources of external capital financing is diaspora remittances, but government has not been able to put together some instruments to drive more diaspora remittance into this country. Things like diaspora bonds, as Ethiopia has done when they are building their Great Renaissance Dam. Things like transnational loans, where the diaspora can actually lend into this economy through a structured arrangement called transnational loans, as we have seen in Tunisia.
Analysts say the debt situation is untenable. In the budget speech last week, Finance Minister Mthuli proposed a US $50 surcharge on new mobile handsets, a move which observers say is one example of the Treasury's desperation to raise dwindling funds. Legislators this week opposed the measures. Still, in the budget speech, Mthuli revealed that the country's external debt surged to nearly US $14 billion in September from close to US $11 billion last year. That's more than half Zimbabwe's gross domestic product. Another economic analyst, Ozo Obina, says that the position taken by the IMF demonstrates that the culture of non-repayment has caught up with Harare. He calls for urgent redress.
Basically, it means the debt overhang is a noose on the country's neck for progress. So we need to develop a Marshall Plan to identify areas that can quickly be, you know, revoked to meet these repayment obligations. $1.52 billion is a lot of money, and that needs to be restructured, and negotiations have to start in earnest with immediate effect.
Mugano highlights the fact that the debt figures revealed last week by the finance minister exclude other heavy obligations, including payments committed to compensating white commercial farmers.
You might want to know that out of this $13.7 billion, it excluded the $3.5 billion farmer compensation bid, which was highlighted by the Minister of Finance in the budget that once the deed is signed, then they're going to add it to the debt again. So which means any time from now, we will be talking of close to $17.2 billion debt.
Mugano says some of the country's debts are the result of political blunders and should have been avoided or settled politically.
Instead of clearing the debt, we're actually increasing the debts. Because if you want to compensate farmers in this country, you should compensate both the white commercial farmers and the black farmers. Remember, the black farmers, after the Land Apportionment Act of 1931, they were kicked out of the farms for many years. Now, if the black citizens, Zimbabweans, and even the farmers who were working in the farms were going to say, we also want to be compensated, don't they have a genuine request to government?
Economic analysts such as Mugano and others say there is no question that whatever amounts are owed have to be repaid. They, however, add that a balance needs to be struck between honoring Zimbabwe's external obligations and macroeconomic growth and survival. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Here's a recap of our top story. A warning by Washington against those who obstruct Somalia's path to peace. And Mali's government denies hiring mercenaries from the controversial Wagner Group. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. International Medical Aid Group Doctors Without Borders, MSF, is calling for local integration and resettlement of refugees living in the Dadaab camp ahead of the Kenyan government's deadline for it to close in 6 months. In a new report yesterday, MSF called on Kenya and its international partners to live up to the commitments made in the 2018 Global Compact on Refugees by allowing Somali refugees to integrate into Kenyan society or to be resettled abroad instead of being forced to go back to Somalia. While Dadaab is no longer the largest refugee camp in the world, it is still home to approximately 232,903 refugees, many of whom were born in the camps. Abigail Lukawara is advocacy manager for MSF. She says conditions at the camp are deteriorating.
The humanitarian assistance has been going down, and most of the refugees are really struggling to make ends meet because they are confined in camps and they cannot sustain themselves because they can't seek for employment elsewhere, and they have very limited opportunities, basically. WFP reduced their food ration to 52% of the required ration.
The government of Kenya says it is still going ahead to close the camp. What are the options for those who are currently in the camp?
The first option is the voluntary repatriation, which is going to be very tricky for Somali refugees because this has been going down for quite a number of years. Like last year alone, they repatriated less than 200 people. So you can imagine a population of 200,000. So voluntary repatriation is nearly out of question for most of these Somali refugees. The other proposed solution was resettlement in third countries and complementary pathways, which also has gone down because the countries that are supposed to offer the opportunities are no longer offering the opportunities as required. They are having their own crisis in terms of refugees from other countries as well. So there are very limited opportunities for resettlement and complementary pathways for these refugees. The third option was integration into the local community, which is a more viable solution. But this is not very clear when it comes to Somali refugees as compared to refugees who are from East African communities. So basically that leaves Somali refugees with very few options.
Are there other feasible options that you are working or talking with the government about?
We don't have other options that we are talking to the government about. The only thing we are trying to lobby and advocate for is for refugees to be given a voice on deciding what works for them. Because the solution proposed cannot apply to everyone, considering the different categories of refugees and their different needs. And we all know the situation in Somalia is not yet stable. There is no clear way of even continuity for care for people who are living with lifelong conditions. So the idea is the camp should not be closed. As much as we don't like the camp idea, because it's been 30 years and people cannot be living in the camp. But refugees need time to be economically empowered, to be self-reliant and to be resilient, so that now they can stand on their own. And even if they are being integrated in the community, it should be a stepwise process. So this is what we are trying to lobby for.
What are the likely consequences if the government goes ahead to close the camp and there are no options for the refugees?
This is going to leave the refugees in a more vulnerable position of exploitation from authorities, exploitation from the local community. And most of them might be forced to go back to Somalia amidst the situation that is there, which will expose them even to higher risk and creating maybe another crisis in Somalia.
What are your fears about the conditions in the camp, the uncertainty of the fate of the refugees, and the reluctance of the Kenyan government to go back on its decision to close the camp?
We all agree with Kenyan government. Camps are not a solution. What we are looking at is how can the international community partner with Kenya to provide durable solutions for refugees. And these durable solutions include having development projects for the host communities of refugees to be able to empower the host community and the refugees to integrate within those communities. Also for Kenya to be a bit flexible with refugees to help them move around, to do business, to seek medical care, because some of them can afford that medical care, but they are in closing camps and they can't move out of the camp, so they can't seek specialized care. So some of the things we are looking at is how can government at least ease on some of those restrictions they have put on refugees so that they are not held hostage. They are not in a state of limbo where they don't know, they don't have any plans for tomorrow because they are in camps. They are confined in a designated area.
That's Abigail Lukawara, advocacy manager for the MSF, speaking with VOA's Chinedu Ofor from Nairobi. South Africa, like many countries on the continent, is grappling with the adverse effects of climate change, which has led many of its cities to ration water and caused livestock to die from dry spells. As a solution, some farmers are now turning to aquaponics. It's a system that uses nutrients from the waste of farmed fish to fertilize plants, which in turn filter water used in fish ponds. Reporter Tuso Kumalo takes a look at one South African company and its multi-million dollar project northwest of Johannesburg.
Johannesburg and Cape Town are two of South Africa's major cities stricken by water shortages. Meanwhile, farmers, especially in the Northern Cape, have lost much of their livestock due to unprecedented droughts. Both problems are linked to climate change. These are danger signs for Lance Alexander Quidding, Chief Executive Officer of the Johannesburg-based Integrated Aquaculture Company. These phenomena encouraged him to develop a joint project with a German company, Desert Foods International. Their efforts have produced an annual harvest of up to 200 tons of organically produced vegetables and fish. The project also shares improved skills with local farmers and employs some from the surrounding communities. Quidding's aquaponics farm occupies less than 1 hectare of land. The project started in August 2021, but now produces tons of nutritious foods with 95% less water and 90% less agricultural land. With this method, vegetables are planted in the same water that is circulated to sustain fish. Speaking to VOA, Quidding describes aquaponics as the most responsible and water-wise farming method that provides a direct solution to climate change.
We are heading into a time where climate is an issue, and we operate in a semi-controlled environment. We use a small amount of water. In fact, it takes us 250 milliliters of water to grow a lettuce, where in the traditional space you use between 50 and 100 liters of water. We need a small piece of land, but also we don't need land that is fertile.
Mapopa Piri Gwengu is a manager at the farm. He says the ability of this type of farming to produce both fish and vegetables under any climate conditions makes it a reasonable response to climate change. Speaking to VOA at the farm, Gwengo made this call to those with money to fund food production.
Do a lot of work on means and ways of improving the yields in aquaponics, also in aquaculture. That will enable people to place and build these farms. These are smart farms. These can be placed in urban areas, in rural areas, to protect our environment and also the climate. This type of system here is not rain dependent. We can place this farm in a desert.
The farm relies on the Desert Foods International Company to provide much-needed technology and funds. Karsten Janssen, the co-founder of the group, told VOA that the next step in their partnership is to extend the knowledge to communities so that they also start their own small-scale aquaponics farms.
It's resource-saving, economically friendly, climate-resilient. It is our strong belief that aquaponics is one of the technologies that will combat climate change, farming practice in harmony with nature.
With many countries in Southern Africa increasingly facing food shortages, Janssen says the time has come to shift from the traditional ways of producing food and adopt those ways that will withstand any type of weather. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington.
For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.